This is the takeaway for August 27th, 2015. This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwolick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. We begin this hour with the migrant crisis in Europe that continues to escalate. Just today, dozens of migrants being smuggled across Europe were found dead in an abandoned truck on a highway east of Vienna. Austria's Interior Minister Johanna Mikl-Leitner responded to the deaths in a news conference.
Today is a dark day, and our thoughts are with the victims, their families, and their friends. This tragedy is shocking for all of us. We all know people traffickers are criminals, and those who still think they're gentle escape agents, they're beyond help.
Meanwhile, thousands of migrants continue to pour into Greece and Serbia, hoping to enter Hungary before officials complete a 108-mile border fence. It's a wall designed to keep such migrants out. Odey, a Syrian refugee from Dara, managed to sneak through the security fence just in time.
We are very hungry. There is no food. There is no milk for children. There is nothing. Okay? We are so tired.
Hungarian officials say the country is overwhelmed by the migrants. They're racing to finish the fence by the end of the month. It's a familiar scenario, especially to those of us who are keeping track of the 2016 elections here at home.
To have a country, you have to have a strong border. You have to have a really strong border. I will build the wall and Mexico is going to pay for it and they'll be happy to pay for it.
But do border fences even work? The one in Hungary didn't keep Odey out. There are many more like him determined to flee war and instability in their home countries. The same can be said for many migrants to the United States coming from Central America or Mexico. We can also look back at the successes or failures of fences and walls throughout history. You're already thinking of them. The Berlin Wall was intended to keep East Germans in. The Great Wall of China built to prevent invasions of nomadic groups crossing the Eurasian steppe. How about Wall Street here in New York? Yeah, it used to be a real wall. Elizabeth Vallée is author of Borders, Fences, and Walls, State of Insecurity. She's also a professor at the University of Quebec at Montreal. And I asked her, do these walls ever even work?
If you try to prevent people from coming in, if you're trying to achieve a security, a sovereignty, aim, no, they do not work. But if you consider border walls, border fences as a public relation operation led by a government which is trying to show his population that he's trying to do something, then they do work. They work as a symbol of political goal, which is to show that you are secure within your territory.
So what do you think then, Madame Vallée, when you see, for instance, the Republican presidential primary with Donald Trump and other candidates pledging to build a wall along the Mexican border? A very expensive billboard, I guess.
It is very expensive. You know, a wall can cost from $1 million to $10 million per kilometer, which is a very high cost for just the construction. And then if we speak about the maintenance of a wall, the border offices in the U.S. have stated that it could be in terms of billions of dollars in the coming years. So it is very expensive, and it won't prevent anybody from coming in. The thing that it's going to do, it's going to affect the economy of the borderlands on both sides of the border, and it will lead the entire business of crossing the border underground. Hence, migrants do not go in the U.S., let's say, for a season of crops or what have you, and then go back home. Once you've crossed the wall, it's so expensive. It's the price of a business class. So it's so expensive to cross the border through the wall that you will be staying on the other side. So you achieve actually the opposite of what you were looking for.
There are also concerns about terrorism. The U.S. has thought about building a wall along our border with Canada because of concerns that terrorists could come through Canada to the United States. Is that a practical concern? What would it mean to have some selective fencing to keep out a terrorist who wanted to access the United States through Canada?
I don't think that could work. And if you look at, you know, what's going on in Syria, young people going from the US, from Canada, from Europe to Syria. They manage their way through very hard and secure borders that are being surveyed and policed because we fear those people going and coming back, and we can't prevent them to go through. So I think the problem with border fences and border walls is that we are not addressing the real issue. When we look at migrants, let's say those that are coming through Hungary and Serbia as we speak, the reason why they're coming is not that they want to benefit from the generosity of the North. It's really a matter of security in their own country. You know, if you take the chance to take your kids with you, cross the Libyan border, cross the Mediterranean Sea, end up in a country you do not know and gassed up, let's say, on the Hungarian border and still want to stay, and you're telling people, I'm not going back, it's really that what you're leaving behind you is so bad that you're desperate. So I think that when we erect fences, whether for terrorism purposes or migration purposes, we don't look at the real problem, and we do put a lot of money in something that is only a symbol, not the real treatment of the real problem.
Well, the Israeli government has very real terrorism concerns, and they say, officials there say, that their wall between Israel and parts of the West Bank has worked. They say it's worked to keep out terrorist elements. So what evidence do you have that it hasn't worked?
I will quote one of my colleagues, Davi Newman, who is an Israeli scholar, a border scholar, actually, at the University of Ben-Gurion in the Negev, who really explained a very good study that the decrease in terrorist attacks following the building of the wall was actually not related to the wall itself, but to an agreement between Hamas and Fatah, and to the pacification of the Palestinians among themselves, which led, you know, to the possibility to discuss with Israel and hence to a pacification of the region. So we cannot see a direct link between the building of the wall and the decrease of terrorist attacks.
Madame Vallée, let's take a moment and go back through the history of walls, because that history is long. We could talk about Hadrian's Wall in Britain. We could talk about the Great Wall of China, of course. Were they successful, or have walls always been kind of a fantasy for those who build them?
Regarding the Great Wall of China, by the time it was being completed, the barbarians were not there anymore. So it didn't serve any purpose anymore. If we speak about the Roman walls, there were some like the Adrian, the Antonine walls in Scotland. And those were designed to channel people in certain places to be able to control the flows. But the border was still seen as an open space or an interface in between two countries, places where you would cross, maybe in designated areas, but you would cross nonetheless. So really, walls were built at that time just to control what was going on, to see what was going on at any time, but not to keep people in, like the Berlin Wall did, or to keep people out.
So what did it mean for those in East Germany and the rest of the world when the Berlin Wall came down?
The Berlin Wall was a significant symbol, and when it fell, indeed, it changed really the face of the world, and with it, we opened a new era of international relations, very much like a hippie type of era, where we were talking about peace, you know, and the world without borders. I think that's really what it meant. 10 years later, it was over, and the borders snapped back due to 9/11. So really, it was kind of an interlude. And still then, when the Berlin Wall fell, we still had a dozen of walls erected and still up during that time. So really, it was more of a symbol than something more significant.
Let's say the U.S. does build a wall along our long border with Mexico. What will the statement be to the rest of the world if we build that wall? What will we be saying?
There is indeed a great wall of civilization, something that divides the world between North and South. And if you look at the walls nowadays, you'll see that the GDP of the countries that build walls is much, much higher than the one that are on the other side of the walls. So it's really showing to the rest of the world that the U.S. is not maybe willing to play the role, not that it wants to play, but that it has to play, because the U.S. are still a superpower within a world that is, you know, having difficulties going through what's going on in the Middle East and what's going on in Europe.
Is it laughable in a way to think of the idea of physical walls in a world that's interconnected through technology and globalized in the way our world is now? Is it almost a joke?
It is a joke, but it is also the backlash of exactly that. People feel they suffer from globalization, from those flows that they cannot control. Hence, border fences and border walls do mean, you know, the return of the state, of the sovereignty, of a certain type of identity. There is something we need to address very quickly, as big issues like climate change will step in. We need to get out of that before we address those issues.
Elizabeth Vallée is author of Borders, Fences, and Walls, State of Insecurity. She's also professor at the University of Quebec at Montreal. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Most Americans learned of Freddie Gray after his death. He was killed by Baltimore police earlier this year. But before he died and before Baltimore exploded with protest, Freddie Gray was another kind of victim. As a child, Gray was poisoned by the lead paint in his Baltimore home. According to a 2008 lawsuit filed by his family, the poisoning led to a number of educational and medical problems for Gray, which may have contributed to his troubles with police. In 2010, the lawsuit was settled, and Gray was awarded a structured settlement. That's a settlement that would be paid out over the course of his life instead of all at once. But then a company called Access Funding came calling. The company encouraged Freddie Gray to give up that yearly benefit in exchange for a lump sum up front, equaling, in the end, pennies on the dollar. And Gray took the deal, and so have thousands of others. Terrence McCoy of The Washington Post looks at Gray's case and many others in his new in-depth investigative piece. It's called How Companies Make Millions Off Lead-Poisoned Poor Blacks. Terrence McCoy joins me now. Thanks, Terrence. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Todd.
Good to have you. Tell us more about these lead poisoning victims. There are thousands of them in Baltimore alone, many thousands more across the country.
That's right. I mean, this whole story begins in a series of lead-painted tenements in some of Baltimore's poorest neighborhoods, like Sandtown, Winchester, where Freddie Gray was from. Those streets are lined with homes that were painted with lead paint. And what that did was it meant that a lot of poor African-Americans were born in those households and subjected to years of chronic lead paint poisoning. And that what that meant for them was that down the road, they had significant troubles reading, significant troubles learning, significant troubles with impulsivity that may have contributed to problems with the law, failure in the classroom, and just overall inadequacies in what we would think would be necessary for everyday life.
Then the lawsuits, then the settlements, then the structured settlements, as I mentioned, settlements that mete out payments sort of yearly over a lifetime instead of all at once. Now, the types of buyouts of these settlements that you described, they're pretty common. Everyone from people with life insurance policies to Bernie Madoff victims have gotten lump sum payments like this, upfront money in exchange for less over the long haul. But the difference here seems to be the condition of the victim going into the deal.
That's right. These stories follow almost an archetypal narrative for a lot of these people who got in these deals where they had a lot of troubles growing up because of the result of lead poisoning. And then once they were awarded their settlement, lawyers cautioned and said, you should really take a structured settlement because this is going to help you down the road to be able to manage the stresses of everyday life. And they thought that these people probably didn't have the sophistication necessary to be able to manage large sums of money. So they said, just take these monthly checks, which are dispensed over a series of decades. And a lot of people did take that. But what that did was it created an opportunity for what's known as a secondary market for companies to come in and say, well, you don't have to wait 500 months for that $500,000. I'm going to give you a lump sum of cash right now, which is significantly smaller than the aggregate or the present value of those dollars. And people thought, well, I should just take that money now because many of these people were desperately poor and oftentimes cognitively despaired or impaired.
And they really needed the money up front, maybe to meet rent, buy clothes, or just have the prospect of $60,000 coming in, brighter prospect maybe than $300 over a lifetime. But there are, Terrence McCoy, there are rules designed to protect payment recipients, even reviews by judges and stuff like that. Why isn't the system working?
Well, the system is set up with a number of sort of vague definitions that are put into these laws. And Maryland is one of the states, was one of the first states to pass what's known as a Structured Settlement Protection Act. They passed it in 2000. And at that time, it didn't really carry a lot of the restrictions that later iterations of that same legislation would carry. So that meant that a lot of these deals can be filed in courthouses or counties far away from where that person lives. A lot of these people came from some of Baltimore's poorest communities. But a significant number of those petitions that in which they were selling off hundreds of thousands of dollars were filed in a courthouse that was an hour away from there. And the question is, do those people even know where that courthouse is? Do they know how to get there? And oftentimes, people wouldn't even go to the court hearings themselves in which thousands of their dollars were being sold.
There's a major ethical issue here, given the fact that the nature of the poisoning in the first place can compromise somebody's intellectual abilities. Plus, people are poor and maybe desperate. What do the companies that sell these upfront payments, which again are common, what do they say about what they're doing and how they're doing it?
Well, I think the common reaction would be that companies are acting within the guidelines of the law itself, number one. And number two is that how are they supposed to be – they're not medical professionals. They're not doctors. How are they supposed to be able to decide whether someone has the mental capacity necessary to be able to understand a contractual document? But that raises an interesting question where it goes beyond even mental impairment, where the question is – poverty itself is very expensive. Disability is expensive. Medical emergency strike or tuition bills or homelessness looms. And these people are kind of stuck in a very desperate situation where this, in addition to being able to profit off disability and the handicap, is also profiting off just desperation and pure poverty itself.
Terrence McCoy, as you did your investigation and you talked to these people before we let you go, were you left with the impression that this is naked predation on the part of these companies?
I don't think this industry is inherently predatory by any means. I think it is something in which companies are operating within what could be called a broken system. And the system itself was not designed to handle a significant number of mentally impaired people with large sums of money. It just wasn't meant to handle that.
A broken system. A broken system perhaps that led to the poisoning of thousands of people in the first place and then was unable to protect them once their settlements came through. Terrence McCoy covers poverty and inequality and social justice for The Washington Post. Terrence, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
We are concerned not merely with the technical problem of securing and maintaining peace, but also with the important task of education and enlightenment. Without such freedom, there would have been no Shakespeare, no Goethe, no Newton, no Faraday, no Pasteur, and no Lisa.
This year marks 100 years since Einstein issued his theory of general relativity. Or does it? You see, part of the Einsteinian revolution is that gravity or distance, even time, those are relative concepts, right? That 100 years, that depends on you. If you were traveling faster, a lot faster, that 100 years could be just a few minutes, not much of an anniversary. Nevertheless, it was a singular event that exploded and created Einstein as an internationally recognized icon, and that's where he remains today.
Oh, yes?
You're Albert Einstein.
Thank you.
What's his name?
Albert Einstein.
Einstein, everyone.
This is it, the thing that'll put us Einsteins into the history books.
Could I explain something to you?
Certainly. What?
The theory of relativity.
Einstein is synonymous now with intelligence and with genius. His equation, E equals mc squared, is one that everybody knows. After all, how many of us can recite the Pythagorean theorem or Boyle's gas law? I can't. Einstein was a celebrity scientist long before television and social media and popular culture made it, sorry, Stephen Hawking, relatively commonplace. So how did he manage to do that? And will there ever be another Einstein? Joining us now to talk about it is Brian Greene. He's professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. He has a recent essay in Scientific American about Albert Einstein. It's called Why He Matters. Professor Greene, welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. So what was so revolutionary about Einstein's theory of general relativity when it came out?
Well, he completely transformed our understanding of space, of time, of matter, of energy, of gravity. So he influenced just about everything in the world around us, a radically new perspective on the nature of reality.
Not only physics and the way objects move and behave, but also culture, art, and popular culture. You know, at the time, Einstein started this argument. You wrote about this. His influence on the entire rest of the culture was profound. General relativity was credited with injecting this idea that, you know, nothing is constant now. Everything is mutable. Walls mean nothing. It gave rise to new music. Igor Stravinsky, Pablo Picasso, modern art breaking all the rules because walls didn't matter anymore. Is that about right?
Yeah, people have absolutely said that over the years. I think it's overblown. There was a movement in the early part of the 20th century that did cause upheavals in art, in literature, in music, and yes, in science as well. But to credit Einstein with really being the moment from which all of those revolutions took place, I think is giving him too much of an influence in those other domains. But his influence in science, his influence in understanding why an object falls, how a clock ticks near a black hole, how the universe began, these are big, incredible ideas, and that is where his influence really manifested itself.
And it's one thing for physicists and mathematicians to pore over equations or argue about this in the halls of Oxford University. One thing that's amazing about Einstein and general relativity 100 years ago is that these abstractions and that physics and mathematics did have an enormous effect on popular culture. I mean, he was a huge celebrity from almost the moment that he was proven right.
Yes, in 1919, there was an experiment observing distant stars during a solar eclipse. And when the observations agreed with what Einstein said the telescopes should see, what the photographic plates should reveal, the New York Times picked it up, every other newspaper in the world picked it up, blaring headlines that Einstein had toppled Newton, whose earlier theory of gravity was the one that held sway for two centuries. And yes, he became an icon worldwide. I mean, there are pictures of Einstein, you know, with Charlie Chaplin on the red carpet. I mean, what scientist would ever be put in that position? So in that sense, Einstein also had a radical effect where the possibility of big ideas could grab the public imagination. And I think that's a vital aspect of what he accomplished as well.
But he also combined what was true genius in theoretical physics with a pretty big flair for the dramatic, for popular culture, for celebrity. He realized, you write about this, he sort of realized what was happening and he liked it.
Yeah, you know, he sort of gave lip service to not wanting to be in the spotlight, but he had a very nuanced, coy way of getting the world to be really interested in this bizarre genius with the wild hair. And it wasn't that he fell into it. I think Einstein was well aware of what was going on and recognized that this was a powerful way of these ideas becoming part of the culture, not being isolated just in academic journals.
Professor Green, at the end of your essay, you say this question isn't just about who the next great thinker is. It also depends on us and what we value. You know, we make celebrities out of the things that we value. And that was kind of comforting. We're in an age where science is relied upon and celebrated, but also maligned and ignored all at the same time, almost these two states of being that exist, and if you catch my meaning. We have scientists who are celebrated for sure. Mentioned Stephen Hawking. We have folks at Columbia, your university, who get on TV a lot, and that's a good thing. Bill Nye, the science guy. Are we at a point where we're valuing science, or is it a caricature? At other times, we argue about this, that it's ignored for political or religious reasons.
Yeah, well, I think there's a huge opportunity for the public to see science in a radically different way than what many people experience in the classroom, which turns many people off. Science is a dramatic story of adventure, and it's up to us scientists and journalists as well to allow the public to experience the wonder of discovery, which is not something that many people do experience. So I would say that I'm hoping that 100 years from now, we'll look at scientists, the great ones, the way we look at the great baseball players of today. They will be the cultural heroes. And when that happens, I think we will, as a society, go to a radically different place.
I'm hopeful that in the unlimited number of universes that are predicted by inflation theory, that there are about a billion Einsteins and Stephen Hawkings who are more popular than whoever Clayton Kershaw is.
A billion is too small, but yes, I agree with the sentiment.
Dr. Brian Greene is professor of physics and mathematics at Columbia University. He writes about Einstein in Scientific American. It's called Why He Matters.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. Curious.com, featuring personalized learning plans that help each member of the household achieve their learning goals, from sewing to Swedish to social media mastery. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. In this last week of August, we're turning our attention to two books about race in America that have sat atop the bestseller lists for much of the summer. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about Ta-Nehisi Coates' latest book, Between the World and Me, that was written as a letter to his 14-year-old son. But today, we're opening the pages of Go Set a Watchman by Harper Lee. Released 55 years after To Kill a Mockingbird, the story follows grown-up Scout, she goes by Jean Louise now, as she returns home to Macomb, Alabama from New York City. Back in the South, Jean Louise finds her hometown and the people she loves in it nearly unrecognizable. Now, readers across the country have been eager to get their hands on this book. To date, more than a million copies have been sold. Several of you Takeaway listeners read it within days of its publication and wrote to us with reviews. We asked three of you from different corners of the country to join us for a discussion. So now, here's Glory Smith, a high school teacher in Provo, Utah, and Reverend Irene Monroe, religion columnist in Cambridge, Massachusetts, along with Josh Drotty, fire inspector in Columbia, South Carolina. Now, like a lot of you, I reread To Kill a Mockingbird before picking up Go Set a Watchman, but we kind of put aside the backstory to focus on characters and the setting, one that Josh felt was deeply familiar to him, even though the book made him uncomfortable.
I think she did a great job of distilling down Southern culture and all its warmness as well as all its coldness in many parts. We, as Southerners, will tolerate a certain amount of otherness as long as we can chalk it up to that, as long as it is otherness. But the second someone in our own ranks wants to be different, whether it's transgender, sexual issues or race or anything like that, if something steps far enough out of the norm, the repulsion you get from what I guess is just traditionalism and paternalism at large is really frightening. But it really, really hit home for me.
Irene Monroe, what do you think about what Josh Drotty from South Carolina has to say about that?
I think he did an excellent job in depicting the South. I mean, I'm a girl from Brooklyn and have never resided in the South, but certainly has gone down there and certainly has seen clearly where even as recent as last year, and particularly in South Carolina, you are supposed to stay in your place. And it's taught to you in a very tacit way, an eye gesture or the way a person clutches her bag. You get the signals even as an outsider.
We all knew the big reveal before we read the book. Atticus Finch turns out to be a Southern racist. But the way it's written, Glory Smith, I wasn't prepared for it. It hits you like a bulldozer. Atticus Finch goes to a racist Citizens Council meeting and is in league with some really vitriolic, sadistic people. And I had to stop reading for a couple of minutes. I knew it was coming, but I didn't know that was coming.
I think I maybe heard some more reviews and knew that was coming. But before that also is when Scout is reading the pamphlet that he's left in the living room. I remember the visual idea of her picking it up by the corner like she was afraid to touch it. She didn't want to be dirtied by this disgusting pamphlet that she went and asked her aunt about and finds out that it is Atticus's. And her aunt has read it too, and what's the problem? For me, that was the first, like, oh, wow, this is awful. But yeah, that was shocking.
Josh, Scout sat in the very balcony, if not the very seat.
Yeah.
Where, as a girl, she watched her father try to save the life of a hapless young black man who was wrongfully accused. She sat in the very seat to watch him in league with these vitriolic people. And it was like a right hook for me.
I feel like that was a big moment for Scout, you know, and for the reader as Scout's narrator. But I wanted to say, being from the South, I held out hope way too long that he would be redeemed some kind of way, that he would explain, you know, maybe he was just at the meeting to, you know, watch these people and make sure nothing got out of hand. Yeah, or
I wanted to believe he was monitoring them.
So bad.
You know, that he
so
was
bad.
He was there just to keep tabs to make sure things didn't get out of control. Irene Monroe, there's another set of contrasts in this book that I thought maybe you could speak to, in addition to the fact that you're African-American. You're from New York. You're from the Northeast, but you're part of the civil rights movement. You know, Scout leaves Macomb County, and she goes to New York, and she's living in the Northeast amongst the liberals. She seems happy there. She goes back home when Go Set a Watchman takes place, and these two worlds crash together.
Yeah, I agree. You know, the very interesting thing about Jean Louise is that, number one, she always felt imprisoned being in that town because she was gender nonconforming. This is a woman who didn't uphold the cult of domesticity. She certainly wore pants to her aunt's disgust. So she comes out of a homogeneous society and is put into a heterogeneous society, and she realizes that the world is much bigger than the parameters of the town in which she grew up in. And so my concern was not so much that Atticus, we find out, is racist. I wanted to know if she was racist. I thought the book was hopeful in this way. She really sort of moved from being a small town girl to what I would depict as a citizen of the world.
It strikes me, gang, that we talk about race relations and culture in the North and the South. The only real character in these books that's fleshed out to any degree, really, is Calpurnia, the paid housekeeper, who, you know, in the second book, really, in a way, closes herself off to Jean Louise when she goes to visit her. What do you think about Cal and the state of relations between her and Scout by Go Set a Watchman?
Well, I think you're right. She's the only African-American character that's fleshed out at all. And I was very sad. I understood it, but I was very sad for Jean Louise. I just felt for Jean Louise there. Really, I felt like that was when her world really crashed. This woman who raised her, they had a mutual love for each other, was kind of shutting her off, and she understood. She understood why. I mean, Jean Louise understood.
I agree. Josh Droughty, the first punch for Jean Louise in Go Set a Watchman is going to the Citizens Council meeting. The second punch, and maybe the knockout blow, is going to see Calpurnia at her house.
Yeah, that's part of the book actually made me want to cry. I mean, it was really powerful. She says at one point, when I think it's during one of her flashbacks to childhood, she talks about Calpurnia's manner. She speaks differently when Atticus has got guests over. And it kind of brought that back to me and made me wonder, you know, there's always this barrier, you know, in a culture like exists in the book and still exists pretty much today, in a much, much milder tone.
Irene Monroe, what did it say to you when Scout went and had her conversation or confrontation, if you want to call it, with Cal and realized that their relationship was over?
I loved the scene. I really did. I appreciate Harper Lee portraying Calpurnia as a liberated woman. When we get to Go Set a Watchman, she's retired because, you know, well, Jim is dead and Jean Louise is a grown woman. She's 26 years old. So I thought it was very, very good because it raised the question, when can a maid be free? I can understand why Jean Louise would ask the question and be concerned, you know, did you really hate us? And I felt like this. It was sort of like what Tom Robinson said. I feel sorry for you. And I think what her statement, Calpurnia's statement, was like, no, I don't hate you, but you never knew me. And how could you know me? Because I was never free in the role, in the subservient and obsequious role I had to play. And I was so happy. It's like, yes, Calpurnia is set free. And she can speak truth to power.
Reverend Irene Monroe, religion columnist in Cambridge, Massachusetts there, joined by Glory Smith, high school teacher in Provo, Utah, and Josh Droughty, a fire inspector in Columbia, South Carolina. That's all for today. If you want to respond to that conversation about Go Set a Watchman or anything else in the show, 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. I'll be back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.